in the strobe lighting of a Lasbolt fusillade. 8 feet of power-armoured terror. She ducked and had a brief image of an axe head, chain teeth whirling, and her legs were like jelly for a moment, and there was gore in her nose, in her screaming mouth. Not just blood, but thick gobs of human hair and flesh, the grit of bone shards and flak armour. Minka bolted upright. It was void black about her. Her hands instinctively whipped her carbine round to fire, but the giant had gone. Her hands were empty. There was sweat on her forehead and down her back. Her brother. She focused on that moment to calm her thundering heart. His name was Tali. She had promised her mother she would look after him. She had done her best. He would be 16 now, a white shield. Maybe he was still alive somewhere. Maybe the Emperor did care. She took in a deep breath. She needed to clear her head, needed to think. She was a sergeant, and the Emperor was watching her, and by the throne. Tomorrow morning, she was going to get her squad into order. Next morning, Minka had a cold shower. She dressed and spit-polished her boots. At 04:55 hours, she was standing on the parade ground with the healthy members of her squad lined up before her. She was tired. Everyone was here, except the new man, Lapdev. "Anyone seen him?" she snapped. Jeremiah stepped forward. The big man stared down at her. He spoke slowly.
"He said he had better stuff to do."
Minka made the big man repeat it.
"Is that so?"
"Yes,"
Jeremiah said. His eyes started twitching again. She found it hard to look at him.
"I told him, but that is what he said."
Minka felt the eyes of all her squad on her. She felt Drino and Belus waiting for her to screw up and bristled.
"Victor, order Corporal Lapdev here, now."
She could feel them all thinking, "Or what? You'll get the bats on him?" Victor saluted and turned, his boots loud on the stone slabs of the parade ground. Her mind's eye followed him through the doorway of the barracks and down the wide stone flags of the screw stair, down to the sleeping bays that opened up on either side. Then Lapdev appeared.
"Corporal, I gave you instructions that the squad were to assemble at 0500 hours for drill."
Lapdev looked at the squad.
"And they're here?"
"But you were not."
"You wanted me to come too."
Minka heard Drino and Belus snigger. Minka's hands were trembling. She'd lost Arctua already, and now this squad were making her look and feel like a rookie. She put her hands behind her back so no one would see and clenched them into fists. She didn't blink as she said, "I assumed that was clear."
"No," he said. "It wasn't."
Minka had read his reports by now. He'd been in service for 6 years. He'd had a number of early commendations for bravery, promotion, specialised in hand-to-hand combat. He'd even made sergeant at some point, though it wasn't clear why he'd been demoted. From his report, she'd expected a type common among the Cadians: fierce, dependable, prone to drink when off duty, hot-headed enough to resolve arguments with his fists. She had not expected such hostility.
"I served with Arctua for 6 years," Lapdev said suddenly. "He dragged me out of no man's land once. I owed him."
"Listen, I'm really sorry about what happened," she said. "If he hadn't been dealing Obscura..."
"Officers like you don't live long," Lapdev said.
"Are you threatening me?"
His gaze narrowed.
"No, I'm telling you the truth."
Chapter 15. The sun rose early on Potence. At 0600 hours, it broke the southern horizon and started to burn down from the clear blue sky. Rodin and Streck, from Janka's squad, were sitting outside their barrack cleaning the squad's guns. They had oily rags in their hands, the disarticulated pieces of Cantrail carbines in their laps. Grogar came out, stripped down to his waist. His chest was tattooed with the Cadian gate and the regimental numbers 101st. He paused
and looked up to where the sun was throwing shadows along the walls of the cathedral as Minka's squad finished their morning run. Their red, sweat-dripping faces said it all, their boots scraping on the iron panels of the drill ground with a ragged patter like undisciplined gunfire, like the local militia or White Shields. Poor Freckers, out for a run in this heat. Minka gave him a look as though she felt herself being judged. In time, she ordered, and the troopers made an effort as Minka led them across the metal drill ground, their footfalls coming in step. Grogar watched as Minka got to the water butt and stopped. One by one, her squad stopped about her, sucking in great breaths. Thrawn, they looked beat. She checked her chronometer. Good job, she called out. Grogar thought she ought to say more, but she was new to leadership. Effective leaders had the knack of saying something pithy or funny or inspiring, always picking the right instrument and striking the right note. Two of the new lot threw their packs to the floor. Sweat sparkled as it dripped from the ends of their noses. Their shirts were plastered to their backs, their armpits were dark. They pulled the helmet straps off and threw their heads back, using their cupped hands to catch water from the ornate bronze water fountain. Another wiped his forehead with his forearm, used his helmet to catch water, put it to his mouth like a ball, and let the water drain down either side of his face. He made way for Minka, but she gestured for him to take more. After a long pause, she called, Fallout! Rifle drill at 10:00 hours! They nodded. No one said anything. They were exhausted. As they went inside, Minka was left standing by the waterspout. The sunlight was starting to glare now. It was going to get hot. She filled her water bottle and emptied it in long, desperate mouthfuls, then filled it once more. Grogar was still watching her. He'd dismantled his squad's carbines, ready for cleaning. He laid each one out in pieces and reached for the next. His fingers knew the twists and clicks like other men knew how to tie a lace. Good run, he said. Not bad. How do the stripes feel? How are yours? He looked at his own arm. One stripe is easy. Two is 5 times the trouble. 3, don't even talk to me. So I'm learning. She ran her hand over her scalp. The stubble was still sharp. They're not in a good shape. No, he agreed. There was a pause. I heard about your corporal. I didn't snitch on him, Minka said. When Shand spoke to him, it was clear that something was up. Grogar said nothing. I hear you got Laptev as his replacement. Yes. Grogar gave a finished lasgun a brief look and set it against the stack, resting against the wall. I'm in the same barrack as him. He's a nasty Frecker. Be careful. Yes, I've noticed. Normally, I'd have him up on insubordination. He's difficult. First rule of command. Don't give an order that can be refused. Thanks, Grogar, she said. I screwed up there. Grogar put another carbine down. Well, you could throw the rule book at him. After Arctua? Minka laughed humorlessly. No, I've got to sort this out myself. Want me to talk to him? You mean, two to hold his arms and two to work him over? No, thanks, I'll deal with it. Sure, he said, putting another las rifle into the pile. Sure, she said. He gave her a look. It'll be fine, she said, more to convince herself. Honest. News came that morning that a troop transport, the Righteous Endeavour, had just arrived in orbit above the planet. Feared lost, the craft's arrival was welcomed with cheers, and it was given priority access to orbital facilities and planet-side landing zones. By noon, the first of the troops were disembarking. Dido was part of the honour guard of Cadians sent to welcome the new regiment. But when she came back to barracks, queasy from the long climb up the Acropolis, she didn't seem impressed. Apparently it's a Medicare evacuation craft, not a troop transport at all. Just a load of sick and dying, and one frecking mountain infantry unit. the skirmishers, not line infantry. A mere 2,000 at most. No armour to speak of.
In his office, Colonel Sparker had just heard the same news and was absorbing it with his mid-morning recaff. The taste made him stop for a moment.
Tyson, who is on recaff duty this morning?
Tyson lifted his eyebrows in a non-committal expression.
Do you like it, sir?
It's magnificent. Tyson stepped forward to inspect the cup.
Recaff seller appeared at the barrack gates this morning, with his own wagon. We let him in, and I thought we'd let you have some. I tried it first, of course, to make sure it was good.
Sparker took another sip. It was thick and dark as treacle, and had a kick like a bullgrox.
Well, invite him back. It's the best recaff I think I've ever had.
Tyson looked pained.
You mean you don't like the usual brew?
Your recaff is very good, Sergeant, but this man must excel at one thing. If we put a las gun in his hand and asked him to fight, I fear he would fall very short of your standard.
Tyson nodded. Point taken.
Sparker lifted the cup to let the last few drops drain onto his tongue.
Very fine. Right, how many defending the planet now? 6,000 Cadians, 20,000 Calabania of unknown quality, and these mountain troops. This is their home turf. They're raised in the Supramonte.
What the hell is that?
It's a plateau to the west of the Evercity. Nothing there of note except for the Astropathic Tower, and foresters, I guess.
Any reports on their quality?
No, sir.
And any idea of the strength of the Scourged?
No idea. Estimates reckon anything between 100,000 and millions. I'd say millions. They'd need that many to take as many planets as they have in such a short space of time.
Colonel Sparker paused. The odds were not good, even for Cadians.
Maybe we could talk to the gangers, he said. There might be another 5,000 fighters.
Grant them a pardon. Give them regular pay. It's been done before.
Yes, sir.
As Tyson and Sparker sat in their office, the recaff seller, a thin, balding man with dark hair and a slight hunch, was doing brisk business at the barrack gateway. Even Chief Commissar Shand came out to see what the matter was.
Has anyone tested the recaff? He demanded. This man could poison half the regiment in one day.
Prasan had a paper mug in one hand.
No, sir, but it is very fine. Here.
Shand took the recaff and smelt it. He took a sip. And then another.
That is very good. I'll take this, if you don't mind, and have it examined.
Yes, sir,
Prasan said, and then watched crestfallen as the commissar walked away with it, taking another sip.
Looks like you've been done,
Dido told him. As Shand walked to the commissariat office, a burial company were carrying a black body bag out of the door on a stretcher. It was Arctua's corpse.
Where are you taking that? He demanded.
Colonel Sparker said to throw it over the parapet.
Shand nodded his approval. Men like Arctua were traitors to the memory of Cadia, and traitors did not deserve burial. He was about to go inside when bells started to ring below them in the Evercity. Shand paused and listened as first one, then more and more began to chime, and then there was a low boom from above as the great bell in the cathedral rang out. He was about to go to find out what had happened when he spotted Grogar taking a bundle of carbines back to the armoury. He hesitated for a moment, then called out,
Grogar, when you've taken those back, come and see me, please.
Grogar saluted, and Shan took another sip of the recaff, then stepped inside and handed it to Noel.
What's that damned ringing for? The commissar said.
I'm trying to find out myself.
Good. Let me know as soon as you find out.
Oh, and Noel, get this tested.
What is it?
Chief Commissar Shan's face remained inexpressive as he said,
It's the best recaff I think I've ever tasted.
Chapter 16. The gangers dumped what was left of Karkul in an open sewer, bleeding, groaning, one eye swollen shut. He could still taste the bread in his mouth, but he knew he was going to die, knew he was done for. He tried to move, but his body hurt too much, and he lay there as the sun rose and beat down on him. But not even its warm touch could help him now. As he lay there, he heard a strange sound, faint on the wind, but then growing in strength and confidence. It was 1,000 bells ringing out from the chapels of the Evercity. It was a joyous and exuberant melody. He had an urge to stand and walk towards it, but he could not stand, could not walk, would probably never walk again. But the bells woke the people of the Tent City. About him, he heard voices lifted in prayer, and a few blocks away, he heard the sound of women ululating and clapping their hands. Karkul started to pray, as Agatha had once taught him, to say his creed, that he believed in the Holy Emperor of Mankind, who sits upon the golden throne and sends his light out to all humanity. He was too weak to do more than whisper, but as he lay there, lips moving faintly, he felt the shadow of someone stopping above him. He kept praying and guessed that this would be the ending. But no blow fell, no knife, no gunshot. A figure knelt next to him, and a man's voice spoke. "You are praying. What is your name, my son?" Karkul tried to speak, but his mouth was too swollen. The stranger lifted Karkul's head and cradled it in his arms. It was a man, but he was gentle. "Do you hear the bells? The sign has been given." "What sign?" Karkul wanted to say, but his voice failed him. "Look at you, my son. You are poor and weak, but you are dear to the Emperor of Mankind. Do you believe that?" Karkul tried to speak, but he coughed and there was blood in his mouth. He spat it out as he tried to blink his eyes open, but dried blood had scabbed them closed. They had beaten him too hard. Only a weak nod showed his affirmation. Finally, he blinked one eye open and saw a thin, bearded mendicant with a four-pointed rich star sewn onto the fabric of his brown woolen overcoat. Karkul could not tell if he had died already. He tried to speak, but his mouth was broken and his lips were thick, and he couldn't form the words properly. "The sign has been given. The sun has gone dark. It means that the feast of Saint Ignatio is almost upon us." Karkul nodded. He knew about Saint Ignatio from his childhood education. He was the man who brought humanity to the Gallows Cluster and drove out the Xenos. But he had never heard of a feast day or bells or anything else that was going on. The figure smoothed a hand over his eyes. Karkul kept them closed. It was easier than struggling. "Hush, you live, my child," the voice said. "Hush, we will make you strong as well. Will you join us?" The words were soothing, but somehow the hands were hard. Karkul struggled to sit up. He fell, but the kneeling figure caught him.
"Are you heretics?" Karkul said.
He thought the suffering that his sins would bring would kill him.
"I cannot join the Scourged."
The man laughed. "No, we are not the arch-enemy. We are the Brotherhood, the armed might of the Emperor of Mankind. We are faithful. If you believe, you will be strong. Do you believe?"
Karkul couldn't speak.
"The Emperor loves you. Can you feel his love?"
Karkul coughed once more. He felt pain, but he wanted to be loved.
"The Emperor loves you, my son. Can you feel his love, like a fire through your veins?"
Karkul winced as pain stabbed through his ribs. He was dying. He felt his heartbeat flutter,
and then the man put hands on him, and after a moment Cargill felt a warmth in his gut that spread to his arms and legs, and the tremor in his heartbeat settled.
"Can you feel that?" the man said.
Cargill said nothing for a long time as the love of the Emperor spread through his body. At last he said,
"Yes, I can. I feel it."
"Good. Concentrate on his strength and he will save you."
Cargill coughed again as the man helped him sit up. He felt dizzy and thought he might black out, but the man held him tight.
"I feel it," Cargill said. "The Emperor loves me."
"Good," the man said.
He placed his palms on Cargill's chest and pressed down. The pressure was so great, Cargill could not breathe. He tried to push the hands away, but the man was too strong, the compression too great. Cargill struggled for a moment, but the crush grew stronger, and then he coughed, and this time there was no pain, just that sense of warmth spreading from his torso to his limbs. He sucked in a deep breath that went through him like an electric shock. His eyes snapped open. There were tears in them that he blinked away. He felt strength and life return. The face that looked down into his was old and lined, with an aquila tattooed under one eye, along with the ordinal 86th. His eyes were intent.
"Breathe deep," he said.
"There."
The man's eyes bored into Cargill.
"There, good. Are you tired of being weak? Do you want to be strong?"
"Yes, I do,"
Cargill said as the man helped him stand.
"Who are you?"
The man said,
"I am the bringer of news. Are you ready to hear the word?"
Part 3. The Emperor will destroy those who hate him. His anger shall be a blazing fire. Song of Vandir. Chapter 1. Tremors ran through the Dauntless class cruiser Admiral Sestina as it began to slow to orbiting speed above Portence. An escort of snub-nosed defence monitors checked her security codes. Once she was cleared for docking, colossal anchor chains unwound from port and aft, and she slowed as these tugged against the high-orbit moorings. The change in speed woke General Benedict. He found himself lying in his marble-lined quarter-deck apartments, trying to shrug off a sleep so deep it had left him feeling confused and disorientated. The oak-panelled cabin was unfamiliar at first, but there was his dress jacket hanging on its stand, with sword and a von Nieder bolt pistol belt slung over the corner of his bed. He stood, a little shaky. He tried to scratch his nose, but there was something wrong. His hand was no longer there. He looked down and saw the bandaged stump of his right arm, and then it all came back to him. Not just the fight, of course, but the whole reason it had happened. The fall of Cadia, the most heavily defended quarter of the Imperium, left broken and shattered. The duel was as nothing, but the memory of his homeworld hit him like a well-aimed punch. Benedict put his hand out to steady himself and clenched his teeth together so hard he could feel them grating, swayed for a moment, and let a low, strangled moan of pain escape his lips. He put his stump to the wall, and sobs tore themselves out of him. This was how he had woken almost every day since the great calamity. The worst thing was that Benedict knew to the core of his soul that everything that damned fool De Barker had said was true. The Cadians had been given a sacred trust, and they had failed. The docking alarms were sounding when Mia knocked.
"Come in," Benedict called, and Mia brought the breakfast tray inside and set it on the table.
Benedict drew himself up. He had dressed himself, and had neatly folded and pinned his right-hand sleeve in place.
"Any word from the shipmaster?" he asked.
"Yes, not good, I'm afraid. Since our re-entry into normal space, we've had a lot of status updates. Some of them are still being deciphered. Apparently, contact has been lost with the planet of Kypra."
"Kypra," Benedict said.
He pulled a space chart towards him. Kypra lay a month's warp travel from the front line. The four had sidestepped the hasty picket at Namara, and their position now put them within a short warp jump from Portence. The audacity of the move was admirable. It was chilling. The speed of the assaults spoke of vast and disciplined forces at the disposal of the leader of the Scourged, Dracul Zar.
"Our foe has made a mockery of the Imperial defence," Benedict said. "He must have a warp-capable fleet as well. He's split the system in half, and once he has Portence, he'll be able to make a move towards Holy Terror."
Mia nodded. The Scourge had cut the Gallows Cluster in half in a matter of mere months.
"That bastard Warmond must have known. He sent me here to die," Benedict said. "He sent me here to fail."
"So, prove him wrong? When we get onto the planet, you can assess the situation. You've got the 101st with you, remember?"
Benedict nodded, though, to be honest, he now feared being reunited with his old regiment.
"I hope they have aged better than me," Benedict said.
The time since Cadia's fall had broken him. He had lost his pride, his reputation, his sobriety, and now his hand.
"Have faith," Mia said.
Benedict nodded.
He had had faith once, but now...
Mia gave him a warning look. There were some things that should not be said aloud.
"I will pray for you," Mia said.
They sat to eat. Mia had cut the ship's slab into small pieces, and Benedict used his left arm to fork his food into his mouth. From classified reports, the 101st had been through the ringer since Cadia. The fight for the hive world of Marquis had been one of the bloodiest fights that the sector had seen. It was one of those hopeless battles that Benedict had seen many times, a gaping hole in a battlefront into which bodies were thrown by the million. Fine regiments, some of the best warriors of the Imperium, had been sacrificed to stem a flood that could not be held back. And its loss had set in motion the terrifying advances of the Scourged. Mia poured a mug of recaf for the general. Benedict rubbed his temples as he waited for the brew to cool. He took a sip. It was thin and sour and tasted of recycled water.
"Very good," he said breezily.
As they went through the most urgent classified reports, Benedict realised that he was being a little brusque. Mia said nothing, which made it worse.
"I'm sorry, Mia," he said at last. "To be honest, I'm a little nervous. There'll be a plaque somewhere, a statue, and a son will say to his mother, 'What was Cadia? Who were the shock troopers?' And the mother will not know. We're a dying force, a dying tradition. Someday, the Cadian shock troopers will be just a memory."
Mia's face said it all.
"Forgive me, sir, but that is frankly impossible."
Benedict ran his hand through his hair. As a general of the Cadian shock troopers, he was privy to the coded communiques of the Munitorium.
"I'm afraid it is very possible. In fact, it will happen. I've seen the numbers. We're losing Cadians at an alarming rate, and there's no one to fill their places. With attrition rates this high, there'll be no Cadians left in 10 years. Where would new Cadians come from?"
Mia didn't answer at first. At last he spoke.
"If we are gone, does the Imperium stand any chance?"
Benedict laughed.
"You speak like a true Cadian. How can the Imperium survive without us?"
"And the answer?" Benedict remembered the last days of Cadia, how he had prayed, fervently, passionately. He tried to speak, but his voice gave way. He had to draw in a deep breath and try to master his emotion.
"I used to be certain about things, but now the impossible keeps happening, and all my certainties have gone.
I'm adrift, like a ship that wanders through the void without purpose or direction. I don't know much these days. All I have is the pride that our fathers and mothers gave us, pride in being Acadian. And if we are a dying race, then we should go down in style, so that the chroniclers remember us well.
Anchor chains were still unravelling as Vector thrusters lit along the 3-mile-long hull of the Admiral Sestina, Servitor pilot slowing its forward momentum to match that of the planet's rotation. It took nearly 2 hours before the ship had settled safely into the equatorial docking bay above Portence, and when they were in position, the distinctive clunk of maglocks vibrated through the craft, and then a stillness settled within the ship's superstructure that could only mean that its engines had been turned off. Disembarkation would begin any moment now. There was a knock on Bendict's door. A Navy rating put his head around the door. He was dressed in the blue velvet jacket and white breeches, typical of the Rich Star personnel, his blue bonnet piped with gilt and a 4-pointed star emblazoned on his chest. He had a thick Gothic accent that Bendict still had difficulty understanding. He had to ask the man to repeat himself before the message was clear.
"From the shipmaster, sir? Mainlander's not departing until tomorrow morning, but his private skiff will be leaving in 1 hour side reel. It's taking members of the Rich Stars down."
"I didn't know there were Rich Stars aboard."
"They requested privacy, sir. Some of them are distraught. I believe a number of them have lost their planets."
"Well, I should have been informed. There's much I would like to know about the Scourged. These people have first-hand experience."
"I will pass that message along. Meanwhile, the shipmaster wants to know if you would like a place reserved as a mark of honour," he said, sir.
"Thank you," Bendict said, rather brusquely. "Yes, I would."
Mia and Bendict were the first to arrive at the small bridge deck hangar, just 1 hour after docking, as the automated day-night system switched from light to the dull illumination of ship night. The shipmaster's pinnace had been freshly painted in deep space indigo. The scent of recycled air and paint hung in the air, but no one else was here yet. A pair of fueling servitors sat inactive against a far wall, mouths hanging dumbly open.
"What is wrong with these Rich Stars?
Maybe they're overwhelmed, losing their planets and all."
"It happens to all of us," Bendict said, even though it wasn't true.
"Well, we travel light," Mia said.
Bendict nodded. Apart from a pistol and a power sword and a well-thumbed copy of The Campaigns of Macarius, he did not have many possessions. Those few he did have, Mia carried in a matched pair of beaten leather travel chests that now sat on the metal grate of the open hangar. He looked at them. They held the sum of his life's possessions.
"Not much," he thought.
An hour dragged by. Bendict cursed as he paced up and down. The ship crew had proved themselves to be generally tardy in all things, something that Bendict found himself unable to come to terms with. He arrived early for all events and stood about with the staff, who looked both appalled and uneasy with this punctual guest. But at last there was activity, as the fuel servitors came to life and the cold air echoed with the shouted reports of approaching crewmen and the low hum of the void lock as it was readied for opening.
"We were supposed to leave an hour ago," Bendict said to the pinnace's chief purser, who wore a long silk gown, belted at the waist with a velvet cummerbund.
"Apologies, Sir General. There was an unavoidable delay," he said. "Gerent Bianca was sick. It took her a long time to finish her breakfast."
"And so we all wait."
"Well, she is the most senior member of the Rich Star family aboard. It is only good manners to respect her repast."
Bendict cursed to himself. He had seen enough of the galaxy to know that it was the ponderous weight of the Administratum that held the Imperium back, not its soldiers. But worse than that, it was the corrupt aristocracy, like the Rich Stars, that fermented unrest and heresy. The pinnace's crew climbed inside the craft. Servitor insets were coaxed to life and lights flickered on inside the cabin. But there was still no sign of the rich stars.
"What is wrong with these people?" Bendict cursed.
But then a bell rang and the pinnace lights came on. The slumped piloting servitors sat up with a jolt as their power cables were plugged into data docks. A few minutes later the pilots appeared. There were three of them, each one dressed in a leather jacket and fur-lined cap. The chief pilot was an ugly-looking man with a round gut and raw wire plugs set into the side of his shaved skull. He sniffed as he climbed up and started throwing switches. The engine started, and at that moment, the first of the rich stars appeared. He was a thin, bearded man, hair white with age and hanging down to his shoulders. He wore a gown of red sequins that exaggerated the paleness of his skin. One arm was augmetic and rested on a bladed metal cane. About him came an entourage of Death World bodyguards with buckskin war shirts embroidered with their greatest conquests, blue feather headdresses hanging halfway down their backs, and power glaives resting on their shoulders. They stopped 20 feet away and eyed the Cadians. The next rich star had a pair of identical life wards dressed in muscled bronze breastplates and ostrich feather shakos, silk pennants hanging from the end of their power lances. The third had two lean women in non-reflective bodysuits with matching blue tattooed faces, white hair, tanned skin, and the look of death cultists in their yellow cat eyes. The fourth had short, stocky wards with fur hats, trident axes and broad sabres. They guarded a child with high-collared gold ruff and carefully coiffured white hair. She sat on a grav throne that swayed gently at the far end of the room, three servo skulls trailing in the air above her head. The last was accompanied by a pair of gen-hanced bodyguards with muscle-slabbed physiques and bronze helmets with horsehair plumes. Their visors glowed red with augmetics, and behind them came a lady in a bodice of black glass, the silk ruff giving her neck a stunted look. "The Lady Bianca," her life wards announced. She was cousin to the Pedrizzo, the head of the Richstar family and resident of the Evercity himself. At a distance, she appeared no older than 16, with plump cheeks and full red lips. But as she came closer, it was clear that she'd been through so many rejuvenate cycles, it was hard to locate her age with any degree of accuracy. Her face had a waxy look, the skin too taut for any wrinkles. Age was in the eyes, Bendict usually found, but these had been modified too. The irises were neon yellow with vertical black pupils, like those of a snake. All the rich stars bowed as she approached, and Lady Bianca ran her eyes over them with an air of weary indifference. She had the balanced, poised, dangerous air of a trained killer. Lastly, she turned her gaze upon the Cadians. It paused briefly on Mia, and then passed on, and Bendict's cheeks coloured.
"You are General Bendict," she said.
Bendict saluted.
"I am glad you are here," she said. "We put our trust in you and your troops."
"We live to serve. We die to protect."
The Rich Star companies made their way onto the pinnace. Bendict and Mia went last. By the time the ramp was cleared, the void alarms were sounding and strobing yellow light played across their faces. But just as the ramp began to rise, two more figures strode out onto the hangar deck. The first was dressed in a plain brown smock and short trews that left his hairy shins and feet bare. A confessor followed behind him, bearing an oversized, leather-bound folio lashed onto his back with tarnished silver chains. As the hydraulics whined shut, the appearance of these passengers brought a tense, reverential air to the cabin. The barefoot man moved along the lines, giving his hand to the rich stars to kiss. Even Lady Bianca bowed as they approached and she took the man's hand and pressed it to her forehead. As the ramp closed with a dull clunk, the newcomer singled Benedict out and strode towards him.
"General Benedict," he said.
His voice was clear and strong and confident. Benedict was not sure if he should bow or kiss his hand, but the man put out a hand to shake. Benedict lifted his stump in apology, and the other man smiled and took his left hand with his own. His grip was cold and strong. He had a fierce intensity about him. He smiled.
"Welcome to Potence," he said. "My name is Shalia Starborn. I am the bringer of news."
Chapter 2 Laptev did not show up for gun drills that afternoon.
"Shall I get him?" Jeremiah said.
"No, I'll go," Minka said. But at that moment, an alarm rang out, and Kranos, the drill master, dismissed the previous squad.
"I'm done with you. Get off my firing range now."
Kranos was a mouth on legs, mean, angry, with two volume settings, loud and louder. He thrust out his chin and roared,
"Hurry up, Sergeant. I don't have time for dawdling."
Minka cursed. "Right," she said, "into positions."
"Come on, troopers, hit the dirt. My grandmother moves faster than you lot, and she's dead."
As they took their places, Minka was so angry that she could barely hold her rifle straight. Kranos marched back and forth behind them, hitting his thigh with his swagger stick.
"In the distance, you will notice stationary targets. That piece of paper wants to kill you. He wants to tear out your eyes and cut symbols into your flesh. Shoot that fricker. Put las bolts through his brain."
The troopers fired as Kranos insulted them.
"Moving targets," he shouted,
and there was a low clunk as the targets started to jolt back and forth. Minka's shots were wild. When the drill was over, Kranos looked at her targets with disgust.
"Two misses, that's a fail. Name?"
"Arminka Lesk."
"Rank?"
"Sergeant, 4th Platoon, M Company."
"How the hell did you get stripes when you can't shoot straight?"
Minka said nothing.
"You've got to move your lips when you speak to me, Sergeant Lesk. I'm not psychic."
"Sorry, sir. I will sign myself up for extra practice," Minka said sullenly.
"Good. If you're not hitting, you're not killing."
"Oh, don't worry. I'll kill," Minka said.
"Well, miss my targets again and I'll report you. Who is your commanding officer?"
"Colonel Sparker."
Kranos filled in the requisite details.
"Now, where are the missing troopers?"
"Thaddeus and Silas are at the Medicare unit."
She pulled the Medicare forms from her breast pocket. The drill master sniffed as he filled out the forms.
"I have 12 in your squad."
He went through the names. When he got to Arctur, Minka had to tell him what had happened. Kranos crossed Arctur's name out and made a ch noise between his teeth, as if Arctur's death were there to frustrate him.
"Has he been replaced?"
There was a pause before Minka said, "Yes, sir."
"Who with?"
"Corporal Laptev."
Kranos's temper was wearing thin.
"And where is he?"
"He has the shits."
"So?"
"Bad shits."
She met his gaze and dared him to disbelieve her.
"I don't like you, Lesk," he shouted. "And I don't like your corporal. I don't care if he shits on my range as long as he can shoot heretics. Understand?"
"Yes, sir."
The next squad were queuing for their turn. They were impatient. Kranos had a tight schedule. He cursed and handed her the sheet.
"Come on, troopers, hit the dirt. My grandmother moves faster than you lot, and she's dead."
Minka kicked the barrack door open.
"Where the hell is Laptev?" she demanded.
No one seemed to know. His bunkmate, a thin, blonde man with an Aquila tattoo on his cheek, shrugged.
"Not seen him."
She went to the canteen, the drill yard where troopers were playing padball, and then to the mess,
where there were three tables of men playing dice or cards under heavy blue clouds of low smoke. She scanned the faces. None of them were Laptev. She slammed the latrine door open, banged on the cubicle doors, marched through the shower block.
"Give me five and I'll be right with you," one of the men said.
"You wouldn't last seconds," she told him. The others laughed as she slammed through the exit and stood in the corridor looking one way and then the other. She was almost giving up when she saw him coming out of the bathhouse. His trousers were wet. He was stripped to the waist, his towel thrown over his shoulders, his block soap, an immunatorum issue net bag in his hand. He was 6'2", built like a rockcrete wall, and she remembered he was a specialist in hand-to-hand combat, but she couldn't hit him without warning him.
"Laptev!" she roared.
He spun round and tried to duck. Her punch caught him on the side of the face. He rolled, hands reaching for her, as she stepped to the side, kicked the back of his knee and half-elbowed, half-shoulder-barged him backwards. The blow threw him off balance, even as his hand caught her arm and dragged her towards him. His breath was sour. He caught her with a body blow, his knuckles bruising her ribs. He hit her again and she ducked twice to protect her head and stepped in close. He hissed, "I'm not taking orders from you," and she spat back, "Yes, you are." They came together, grappling as they got the weight of each other. He was stronger than her, and within moments he had his forearm under her chin, one fist clamped in the other as he pulled his grip tight.
"I'll break your neck if you try that again," Laptev said.
He tightened his throat lock to make his point. He was good, but Minka was better. She struggled and he tensed, and then she went limp. He relaxed his grip and she threw herself forwards, hooked her leg about his knee and twisted his hand down onto the forearm. The big man went down like a sack of meal flour. The thud took the wind out of him and he lay for a moment, blinking in surprise. Minka kicked him in the side. He doubled up.
"If anyone is breaking necks, Laptev, it's me. Understand?"
He lay on his back for a moment, then rolled to the side and pushed himself up onto his elbow.
"Going to send me to the bats?"
"Not unless I have to." He stood and dusted himself down. She had her fists ready, but she'd made her point.
"I'm your sergeant and you'll obey my orders. You'll go to the firing range when I tell you, or I will show you what hand-to-hand combat is really like."
That evening at mess, Minka's ribs hurt. Prasan winked at her and she cursed him and sat alone, and she was happy no one tried to come and speak to her. Only when she slid her tray into the washing-up box did Tyson fall in next to her.
"What happened to your face?"
"Nothing," she told him. He did not let her get away.
"Red Skulls?"
"No," she said.
"Which one?"
"No one." Tyson had always struck Minka as a big, stupid man with a big mouth, good for shouting out orders. But now he put a hand on her shoulder.
"Listen, I heard you kicked Laptev's backside."
"No."
"They've been through a tough time."
"Haven't we all?" Tyson patted her shoulder.
"Yes, but he has a good record."
"Are you blaming me for Arctua's death?
I didn't feed him Obscura."
Tyson saw that he had annoyed her. He tried to appear conciliatory.
"Just do your best. We don't want anyone else being shot."
"I hear you," she said. She was angry, and rather than speak to Tyson further, she turned and stalked off. Chapter 3. When they landed at the starport, the Pedrizo's own lighter was waiting for his relatives, while a military salamander waited for General Benedict. The Rich Stars hurried aboard. There had been a time, long gone, when the Pedrizo of the Gallows Cluster had lived in the palace on the top of the Acropolis in the Basilica. Now the Rich Star dynasty was housed a little way down the high rock, on a jutting headland that thrust straight out about 400 yards from the summit, and 200 yards below the intake barracks, in a complex known as the Calvert. It was to this dwelling that Lady Bianca and the other lesser Rich Stars were taken. From above, the Calvert complex seemed a modest affair. There was a high wall of red brick, providing privacy rather than defence, and then the long tiled roofs of the palace's wings and contemplatorium, with a neatly clipped garden and the dark green of ancient, crooked pines. Bianca's father had brought her here for the feast of St. Ignazio 200 years earlier, and she had the vague memory of following two steps behind him, winding through ancient tunnels and baroque chambers that housed garderobes, oratories, ice houses, solas, butteries, and cabinets of ancient curiosities. She mused on this as the craft hovered over the palace compound and then descended on its vector thrusters. Lady Bianca was first out. The lighter had settled in the lower terrace, a high walled garden with low knotworks of carefully manicured evergreens and carefully tended flower beds arranged in steps up to the purscreen wall of the contemplatorium. She breathed deep and looked up to the pale rocky limestone crags that rose up behind the palace and had a brief impression of the size of the cathedral at its summit. She did not have long to enjoy the view. A man was hurrying down to greet them all. She noted that it was not the Pedrizzo himself, but his equerry, Chantal.
"Lady Bianca," he said, bowing excessively low, "we are honoured."
"Not so honoured that the Pedrizzo will walk down to greet us personally. Is he working?"
"Yes, my lady. It has been a matter of great concern that so many of the pieces that he created with his own hands have fallen into the hands of the enemy."
"Sacrilege."
"Indeed, Your Highness."
Chantal started to say more, but then Shalia Starborn appeared, padding down the ramp on bare feet.
"My Lord Starborn," Chantal said, kneeling. "Welcome. You are expected, and, as you requested, everything is made ready."
"What is going on?" Lady Bianca demanded.
"It is the feast of St. Ignazio. The augurs have declared it imminent," Chantal answered. He gave a thin smile. "Come, follow me. We are expecting great things to be portended. The promised days are coming. The rich stars have been chosen. And today a huge honour will be bestowed upon us all."
"Here," Chantal said, and showed the rich stars to the Room of the Virtues, deep in the rock. Lady Bianca walked into a bright and airy space. Chantal read her expression.
"The room is lit by a relay of mirrors and pipes that bring daylight down into this subterranean level. The Pedrizzo used to paint here, but he has become more earnest now and devotes himself exclusively to iconography. He has found his private chapel more suitable for that particular kind of work."
They nodded attentively and admired the frescoes as Chantal bowed and slipped out of a side door.
"I will see if the Pedrizzo is ready to see you now."
The Pedrizzo was the honorary title given to the senior member of the Richstar dynasty. The current Pedrizzo was named Erdelig Richstar, the fourth to bear that name, and 83rd direct descendant of Lord Marshal Ignazio Sola. He lived a quiet, almost hermit-like life, in meditative silence, under the glassaic windows of his private chapel, set deep within the lower levels of his palace. Today he was working, earnestly, on a miniature icon for a chapel on Gallon 5. His emperor had dark hair, full battle plate, skin of gold leaf, and eyes of radiant crystal. He had the finest brush of red sable with which he laid down the glue for the gold leaf, which trembled in every breath of air. The backdrop was how the Pedrizzo imaged Holy Terror had once been, when the emperor trod its fields. It was green and verdant, with fountains of clear and refreshing water. The chime rang from above, telling him his guests had arrived. He moved quicker now, pressing the gold leaf into place. He wanted to finish the left cheek before he was stopped. There were so many interruptions these days. Too many interruptions. Too much news in general, and all of it bad. He bent over his icons as he felt the rumble of ancient doors opening above him. They were locked with ancient bioscreening that would only let members of the Rich Star line through. He knew the sound of each door as it fell shut, and recognised the clip of expensive boots on the tiled floors. He knew how long he had left before he was disturbed, and let out an exasperated sigh and started washing his brush, straightening the bristles in his pursed lips. He held it up for a moment to check the point, and then set it on the stand and drew in a deep breath and stood. Life had taught him many things, some useful, others not. But one truth he held on to was that whenever one had a job to do, there was never enough time. When all was ready, Lady Bianca and the others were led down a narrow corridor to the side doors of the chapel. Two of the Pedrizzo's life wards stood at the end of the corridor. One of them was a four-armed warrior who answered to the title of Moroi. The other was a Carthay warrior named Urin, whose platinum hair was plaited close to her head. She moved with a beguiling litheness, typical of those who had studied Eul Ura Skrairi. They both stepped back politely, but the mass of Moroi's gene-crafted physique forced Lady Bianca to squeeze past and up the three steps. The domed chapel was modest in size, but that was where the modesty ended. The rest of it was an indulgent cacophony of religious statuary, paintings, and richly illuminated devotional texts. At her feet was a swirling mosaic of black and white marble, porphyry insets, and intricately carved marble pedestals. The walls were awash with a cycle of murals depicting the struggles of the emperor and the life of St. Ignazio, and sculptures of the ancient scions of the family, whose busts stood on low pedestals of silver filigree. The ceilings seemed to soar above the head of the viewer, with images of the sky and space, and St. Ignazio's ancient battlecruiser, the Arnulfiad, on its conquest of the system. Gold-leaf Baroque cornices mimicked the architecture of a building, with the long spines of roof supports carved into the rock, and bosses carved with the likenesses of imperial preachers, their eyes wide, their mouths closed, their helmet visors pushed back, the ends of their las rifles poking up by their faces. There were chapel tombs and frescoes, catafalques, inset altars, confessionaries, and a dozen examples of the Pedrizzo's finest icons hanging mute on the walls. All the devotional energies of 6,000 years were concentrated into one private and reverential place. The impact of the beauty and history stunned the Pedrizzo's guests. Even Lady Bianca paused and found her gaze lifted to the exquisite ceilings. Her cousin's recent intense work had been in response to the fall of Cadia. The Pedrizzo had taken off his apron, but he still looked underdressed for the occasion in silk slippers, belted robe, and a floppy, tasselled cap. "Greetings," he said, welcoming each of them. "Here we are gathered in the light of the Golden Throne. It is upon our shoulders that the burden of decision-making falls. I welcome you in this hour of travail that has come upon us. It cannot be a coincidence that the skeins of fate have brought you all here just 2 days before the feast of St. Ignazio." "It is not chance. I have seen portentous things in the tarot," Shalia said. "Great events are about to unfold here on Potence, where our forefather, St. Ignazio, first brought humanity to these stars. And by his grace, you will decide whether this is the time for which we have all waited." There were murmurs of assent, but the air within the room was breathless, tense. Shalia spoke again. "Yes, we have a momentous decision to make. We have clung on to our ancient faith for centuries, while the ecclesiarchy mounted purges and pogroms and punished any who held on to the old ways.
Many of our forebears suffered greatly. One way, one road, one path that leads to salvation. I think we should take our dilemma to the saint.
Surely not.
The Pedrizzo's face showed alarm, but Charlia looked about for support.
What greater need could we have?
But to disturb his rest.
If we do not act now, then all that he built will be lost to the ruinous powers.
The Pedrizzo paled visibly, but he was not a man with a strong enough will to resist them all. He looked pathetic as he turned to Lady Bianca.
Lesser cousin, I do not advise this course of action. It is extreme.
She put up a hand and cut him off.
Will the saint speak?
We shall have to consult him to see.
Bianca's yellow eyes widened.
To see the saint? That would be a rare honour.
Chapter 4. A staircase led down beneath the altar. They followed Charlia, who stopped before a tall, ornate plas-steel door, set with bas-relief panels. Lady Bianca stepped forward to examine the panels.
These show the 12 cleansings.
Each one depicted one of the 12 Xenos races that Ignazio Richstar had wiped out in order to make the sector safe for humanity. In the middle of the door was an ornate biolock. It is coded to Richstar blood only, Charlia announced. He ostentatiously slid a finger into an indent on the middle right-hand panel. There was a faint, almost inaudible click as a needle entered his fingertip, extracted a pearl of blood, and confirmed his identity with a whirl of biomechanical cogs. The door did not open, but slid back into recessed tracks in the wall, and as it did so, lumen globes flickered to life, illuminating another long, broad staircase. Faint music began to play. It was the sound of a choir chanting ancient hymns. Charlia held out a hand.
Tread carefully, brothers and sisters, to the hall where our forefather himself is laid.
The black marble staircase led them down so steeply that some had to hold on to the metal railing to steady their descent. Behind them, the lights flickered off, while ahead of them, more lights blinked, which gave the odd impression of being on an endless staircase. After a minute or so, the walls to either side were no longer dressed, but raw stone, still marked by the swirling pattern of the adamantium mole that had burrowed the tunnel. The air grew chill, there was a musty smell. Then, suddenly, the steps ended, and they found themselves in a simple, rough-hewn chamber. Two tunnels branched off to either side, lit by low candles set along the floor at 50-yard intervals.
Welcome to the place of death,